Hello and welcome to season 3 of A Theatre Maker in Mzansi. Yeah, we need to do better on that theme song, but this is going to be another amazing season of your favorite theatre podcast from South Africa. I've got some really awesome creatives that I'm going to be talking to, and you know, we've done a location change, so now I'm based all the way in the Western Cape. And so the first episode that I have for you from the Western Cape is a sit down with Johnny Younger, who is the creator of Johnny Younger Productions, which is the production company that brought us Hamlet, the puppet production that came to the Baxter Theater. And it was so serendipitous that I was teaching this production, and so it's awesome that I get to sit down with Johnny and talk to her about her career, talk to her about the production itself, and talk to her about the future of the production. So I hope that you really enjoy this episode that's coming up right away. Season 3, Episode 1 of A Theatre Maker in Mzansi. Here we go. Maybe let's just start with like your kind of beginnings and how you got into like making theater, and then maybe we can talk about how that led to make like working with puppetry and that kind of thing.
Well, actually, I really started into theater through puppetry. Uh-huh. So I was studying fine art. Oh, wow. I my first degree is in tertiary degree is in fine art, mm-hmm. Majoring in sculpture. Mm-hmm. And I was in my fourth year building, doing wooden sculptures and sure. listening to the radio. And during that year, it was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission on the radio, and I was listening to it. And then I went to the National Arts Festival. I already had an interest in puppetry. And I saw Uber in the Truth Commission mm-hmm. with Handspring. Mm-hmm. And it really just, for me, emotionally connected what I'd been hearing, you know, through the radio in a new way. It gave me a new emotional relationship to the history that was being spoken of. Mm. And for me, that really felt like we can use visual storytelling in theatre mm-hmm. to open windows of life for people on how we're interpreting our worlds. Mm. So I became very excited about the possibility of puppet theatre for adults. Mm-hmm. I had also seen Philippe Gentil's work, who creates very dreamlike, illusionistic spaces. Mm-hmm. And that was also fascinating for me, very, very different from Handspring's work with Kentridge. Mm-hmm. But the combination really excited me about the way we can speak about being human in a way that goes beyond the literal, you know, because our television medium and so many other forms of theater are very much about narrative based in the same reality where we experience most of our day-to-day existence. Mm-hmm. But my experience of being human, and I think a lot of ours, yeah. is that there's so much more to us. Mm. The complexity of elements of ourselves that interact. And when I saw those productions, I started to get a sense, oh, this thing, this puppet thing, this is exciting. This could really be an avenue that I would be interested in following. And then after that, I went and applied to the puppet school in France. They do a 3-year tertiary training. So I thought, well, if you're going to do something like puppetry as a profession, you better like go get a serious degree right. and take it seriously, right. you know, because otherwise you're going to be doing rinky-dink puppet shows right. in people's garages for the rest of your life. That's not where I wanted to go.
Sure.
So I went off to France and auditioned for this school. It was really quite hard to get in. Mm. I didn't get in at first, but sure. I managed to get myself in the sure. end. I think that's relevant because for me, being a theater maker, a lot of what actually sees me through as a professional theatre maker is an extreme level of determination, you know, just being super tenacious.
Right.
I'm like tenacious
right.
as hell.
Right.
And I don't know like how people manage who don't have that tenacity yeah. because yeah. it's really just, you've got to not give up. So right. like, I didn't get in the school at first, and then sure. I just carried on and went sure. to see the director sure. and showed more work. And then eventually I did. So I did this 3-year training in France.
Okay. What did the audition look like? I'm just curious about
so
that.
It was it, there was first I had to do a performance in French of with a puppet and then a piece of classical theater, and this is hilarious because in the booklet that advertised the thing, it said a piece of classical theater, the translated English thing. Now of course, as you know, in English, when you say a piece of classical theater, it means the Greek classic,
yes,
right? But in French, when you say classical theater, it means not puppet theater. So not physical performance, not like, you know, wordless stuff with objects, but conventional theater,
right.
What we would say conventional theater text.
Right.
So there I was doing, like, without any theater training, none, no undergraduate theater training, because straight from my fine art degree, there I am doing, oh my God, it was not good. Anyway, so that was the first audition. And then they had, after that first audition, they had a week-long audition.
Okay.
Where you could stay and show more of your skills what you're interested in with regard to puppetry and performance. It was really a very thorough audition process. They only take 20 students every 3 years.
Wow.
So that's why it was quite a big effort to get in and why they do such a long audition.
Sure.
Anyway, that's a whole nother story.
Right.
Nothing to do with Hamlet.
Sure.
Anyway, then I came back to South Africa and did my master's in theater.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at this point, I'm asking myself, what the hell? Now you've got as much education as your super specialized pediatrician sister. But, you know, it's all this
from Shout out to the sister.
But I think it was really what I needed was a grounding of community in the theater world here in South Africa.
Sure.
So I'd gone from the fine art world, gone off and studied puppet theater. Mm. And then I came back here and I didn't know theater people. And you can't make theater on your own.
Right.
You need a community of people.
Right.
So for me, that's what my master's was about. It was about building a community of people. But what was interesting about it was it led me deeper into my thinking. I didn't go to think more, but I was forced to think more because I was doing my master's.
Sure.
And it really led me on to articulating what was most pertinent for me in puppet theater. And it is this thing about the way we can reflect multiple aspects of a single human being through the way that we manage the body and those that are controlling it.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that became part of like a signature, if you will, that is inside of quite a bit of my work.
Mm-hmm.
Not everything uses it in the same way, but I'm very interested in how we reflect these multiple layers, you know, whether it be the dream aspects, the illusion of our vision of what we call ourselves or our world that we live in versus, you know, what is actually there, which we don't really know.
Right.
Anyway, that's a very long answer.
Yeah, but that's
forgotten the question right there.
that's the nature. I love when questions kind of like open up a big door, right? So how does that then lead to you picking up Hamlet and deciding that I want to work through these ideas with this text?
So how Hamlet came about was, I had been doing quite a number of original works, developing the content either myself or usually in partnership with the cast. Maybe, you know, like Origins was created with a choreographer, and Firebird was also created with a choreographer, Jay. So developing the content very much in collaboration with the cast and then working out a dramaturgy and building puppets for that.
Yeah.
So that was how I had worked pretty consistently in creating most of my work. But I became interested in, towards the end of 2018, 2019, somewhere around there, in what does it mean to work with a pre-written text?
Right.
And so I started to consider, you know, where to go. And being me, I just think, well, let's go straight to the heart of it. Let's do Shakespeare.
Yeah,
so it actually came about through that. I thought, I think it's time to do something serious, you know, because now I'm actually all my theater is mostly for adults. I do make work for young audiences as well, but generally I do work for adults. So it's not that it's not serious, but I thought there's something wonderful about working in collaboration. And in a way, when you create on the backbone of somebody else's text, there's a kind of collaboration with the author, whether he's there or she's there or not.
Right.
You're building on somebody else's creation.
Right.
And one of the things that I find about puppetry is it is a little bit fringy. They're people who are going like, what is this puppet thing?
Sure.
And I thought to myself, well, wouldn't it be interesting to try and bring it right into the center of the center? Uh-huh. Like, what's more central than Shakespeare? So that was the initial thinking. Sure. And then I started to think about which text within Shakespeare, what do I love? Hamlet really stood out for me because of who Hamlet is. Mm. The complex way in which he engages with himself. Mm-hmm. His unanswered questions. Mm-hmm. I mean, the to be or not to be is probably the most quoted,
right?
You know, line
right.
in the world.
And people probably don't know where it comes from, right?
Yes, exactly. Right. And but he's just full of these questions that cannot be answered. And sure. for me, that's a very beautiful space to be in as a human being, but also as a theater maker. Mm-hmm. What does this existence of ours mean? Mm-hmm. And what would stepping into it in one direction or another mean for me right now, and therefore for all of us in whatever context we may be in.
Right.
Yeah, so I thought Hamlet, that would be great, but I wasn't truly in love with Hamlet until I really started to do it.
Okay.
I understood what an amazing piece of work it is.
And what was the hook in for you, if you remember?
So the hook was that... because like I told you, I came from the fine art world and then I jumped into this puppetry, theater right. tertiary degree.
Sure.
And then I came into my master's. I never did an undergraduate in theater. So okay. I have always, and I don't really think it has to do with my education, but I think that as human being, and I know I'm not alone in this, I do feel like a bit of a fraud in this life. Like, who am I to do anything?
That imposter syndrome.
Yeah,
right.
exactly. Sure. I've got a big imposter syndrome.
Sure.
So I thought, who am I to do Shakespeare? I don't know. I don't know. I don't know. Mm. And then my way of solving that problem is to surround myself with fantastic artists.
Right.
So I just gathered a team of people that I knew I trusted. At that time, it was Roshina Ratnam, mm-hmm. who plays Polonius and Gertrude. Yes. And Mongim Tombeni, yes. who's also a playwright himself.
Uh-huh. Right.
And he's in Hamlet. Yes.
Right.
And he's just the most phenomenal creative mind.
Yeah.
I mean, somebody who can think laterally mm-hmm. at a level that, you know, I don't know many artists that can think laterally like he does and create at the same time,
yes.
visually, physically, interpret with objects. Mm. I mean, it's just an extraordinary person to have in a creative space.
Sure.
So there's Mongi, there's Roshina. Tim Ripoth did an amazing piece of puppet theater and had been part of a company specifically focused on Shakespeare called Framework Company, mm-hmm. and he had done this thing called Mush, which was a one-person show with a whole bunch of puppets. And he had been in Edinburgh, and he had done some really amazing work with puppets, and as a performer, he got the Brit Golden Award, went to the Shakespeare, anyway, and then he had just disappeared.
Sure.
Sort of, I think the pressures of being a freelance performer. Anyway, right. I dug him out of the woodwork. I said, Tim, come
back.
I need
come
you.
Back.
This is your. This
sure.
is the project.
Sure.
And he absolutely loves Hamlet.
He's an amazing
passionate
choice.
About it.
Oh, man.
And then there was Andrew Buckland as well, who wasn't fine. I mean, he was in the version we took to the National Arts Festival.
Okay. Sure.
He was Claudius.
Mm.
Tim was teaching at the time. He
I
wasn't
see.
Able to do it. So
sure.
Andrew was in then, and then Andrew was in Oedipus,
mm-hmm.
so he wasn't able to do this run, so Tim took up. So they, but right in the beginning, what I did was surround myself with these powerful theatre makers, all of them, and I asked myself, well, if I have some concerns, the legitimacy of me doing Shakespeare, how does somebody who is not a first language English speaker feel? How does somebody who perhaps hasn't got 3 degrees behind them feel? You know, I feel like a fake. How does somebody who doesn't have all of that behind
right.
them feel with
sure.
regard to getting into Shakespeare? So
sure.
no, we need to do something. Not only so that I can access this play and feel like I've got a sense of rooting in it, but that a whole lot of other people can. So we
right.
ran a workshop called Owning Hamlet,
mm-hmm.
which was only a week. And each one of us presented something from our wheelhouse.
Mm.
So obviously my presentation was all about puppetry. Roshina did a whole thing on the dramaturgy. Tim did the iambic pentameter. Andrew did physical performance. And then we had 15 young people from various different backgrounds, none of whom were from, none of whom had qualified through a tertiary system.
Right, right.
Come and participate. And so you were asking about the hook. Here comes the hook.
Sure.
The hook was really the passion that community of people brought. And when we explored together the amount of richness, the amount of relationship that we discovered with this text, that it wasn't this, you know, I'd never wanted to do some prince from Denmark. Mm. But in the beginning, in my mind, it was all about like the interior of a mind space, you know, because you can see that's kind of where my work goes.
Sure.
But as I worked with this community of people, it became about a kind of much more, who are we inside of Hamlet and who's Hamlet inside of us?
Right.
That became the question. Mm. And I totally fell in love with it then in there, in that process. And I felt like I really had my place as I walked alongside the 15 other people who I considered myself to be on a level with, as we all discovered, what does this mean to access this work of Shakespeare?
Sure.
It was a really great process. And out of that came the three of the performers, and then Tsiamo joined us later as part of an extension of that process. And the only reason I'm singling her out is because she does have a degree from UCT.
Right.
And Beviol, in fact, was at Magna Theatre. So I don't want to undersell their skills and their training.
Sure.
But Sam and Siam Tanda don't have that formal tertiary experience. Mm. And I think that Siam Tanda, you know, I'm particularly proud of how he joined in and has become such a huge contributor to the process.
And he plays
Hamlet
with Mongi.
And also Laertes.
Right.
And he, you know, his memory for text is absolutely word perfect. He helps Mongi.
Wow.
You know, whose first language English speaking. And, he just has an amazing mind, and his emotional relationship with the text is very profound. His experience in performing and delivering is not, you know, as high as some of the others in terms of just years and training and all of those things.
Right.
But I think that each and every voice that we have in that cast is giving the unique character of our Hamlet. And that's what I fell in love with, is what I've remained in love with about the production
that's
all
so
the way
awesome.
Through.
That's like, I mean, watching it was quite a trip for me, because it was like seeing the separation and divisions that are inside of a human soul, right? So like there's this, when I've been doing a bit of research myself, and one of the actors who played Hamlet historically, he says it's kind of like he goes into conversation with the synapses inside of himself, right? And when I saw the moment where I think it was Siam Tanda who pulls away, and the face of Hamlet is engaging him and listening to him as if it's also, but it was just like, this is how I sometimes feel myself, right? When I'm, you know, it feels like there are multiple currents flowing inside of me, and I'm contending with them, and I'm not sure which the right one is. And that just became a beautiful visual representation of that.
Thank you. I'm
going to ask you to talk about that. But first, I'd like to hear, how did you start making the puppets and settle on the expressions on each face?
So the making of the puppets also started with the Owning Hamlet workshop. And as always, well, I find as always in my life, in my production process, there isn't enough time and there's not enough money.
Right.
And the final puppets were, there was a vision for what they were going to look like. And then I had like literally some days and this workshop starting. And I said, I need some puppets.
Hey.
I need some puppets.
Sure.
So I just pulled out my polystyrene that I had in stock and started hacking out some heads.
Sure.
And I had this, I was like, I need a something that can, you know, kind of cover them and can flow and can be, you know.
Yeah.
And then I thought of Hessian, and I covered over them with this Hessian. And then I had designed even these very temporary puppets to have these shoulders, and I managed to get shoulders on like two of them, and the rest didn't have shoulders because I didn't have time.
Mm.
And that was literally how the puppets came about, because what happened, the magic, was when I brought these half-finished, strangely built sketches of puppets into the space, was I found there was so much more magic in them than in a lot of other puppets that I've built, which are so
complete.
And then there's no, like, they don't have that flow of life energy that that these Hamlet puppets have, which is connected to the fact that they are fluidly moving with the performers.
Yes,
when you've got an arm that bends like this and drops like that, if you let go of that arm, you've got a dead limb.
Mm.
If you have a leg and you don't move it, you've got something hanging in the space, and
it
looks bang,
yeah,
with puppetry. Sure. You don't control every single bit. So then you need three people to control one human body. Right. Can you imagine how expensive that is? Isn't it? So you have to have three people. But also, it gives a beautiful look, which is different from the normal human body. And it is something quite magical. But at the same time, it is still limited in its outline.
Mm.
And what we discovered in play in that Owning Hamlet workshop was how this unlimited outline allowed us to separate and allowed us to create inside and outside of the body of the puppet in a new way.
Right.
So that was just a delightful discovery. And then I had to afterwards, like, for example, the puppet who's the ghost currently, that was Hamlet in the first workshop. Oh, and then I was like, no, this guy's too old.
Yeah.
I need a remake.
The other Hamlet.
So then also with too little time, I had to sculpt another Hamlet. Always with too little time.
Sure.
Because we had another workshop. We did it with two workshops, and the second workshop was in 2020. And again, it was like limited funding, short period of time. But we did almost the whole show. We did 1 hour and 45 minutes, so half an hour less of it. But we did that in a 10-day rehearsal process with the same team of people. So poor Mongi, he nearly died. I don't think I really quite understood what I was asking of him. but it was amazing the energy that put into the puppets, into the team, and into making it possible. And that was where we really started to get to grips with what our Hamlet was going to look like. Right. The first workshop was all about playing with images, hurling the puppets around, trying to figure out iambic pentameter and how to speak in a way that means something.
Right.
And then the second workshop was really where we started to say, oh, this is our Hamlet. This is our edit. We're going to cut this scene out. We're going to put this in. We're going to say these lines like that. Mm. So that was a...
How did you do that work? Because, you know, there's stuff that's been left out. There's stuff that's kind of been... reduced a little bit. How did you condense it to 2 hours 15?
So that's like half the play.
Right.
It's a 4.5 hour play. Sure. And I'll tell you how we did it. We did it like this. So I was very clear that this is Hamlet's story. And there's a layer on the story which is not about Hamlet. It's about his father and about fate.
Yes.
About, obviously, it's about, the fact that his father, everything that he sets up in his life, is actually pulled down by this command of this ghost.
Yes.
Right? Cool. He sets up all this...
begins this
The political victories, his family, everything is destroyed by this demand for revenge. And I think that ultimately is a very important part of the message of the whole play. And I love it. It's a lot in one play. And 4.5 hours... originally this production was destined for Maynardville and outdoors 4.5 hours, it's not happening.
Yeah.
So I wanted to focus on Hamlet.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he in himself captures a lot of that question anyway.
Yes.
So already we knew that we wanted to cut out everything that was not to do directly with Hamlet's journey.
Right.
And then... So that edited a lot of things. Then we want to cut out everything that was really difficult to understand and not very pertinent to the decisions that need to be made. So we cut within things. There's a lot of reference to images and things that are dated, that are from the period, contextual, whatever. Sure. So we cut out everything that we felt was going to be difficult to understand, that we found difficult to understand. Right. Literally, if we had a cast member who couldn't understand what they were saying, we would look at it and go, how critical is this to what the character is saying, to the point of the scene? And if it wasn't critical to those things, we would all have a big fat argument about it and then end up cutting it off. It's so important, it's so great.
Right.
Of course, you have to just make choices, So we would do on the basis of what's driving the action, what's driving the character, what we need to communicate.
Right.
And what is not essential to, I think for me, I was the one standing up for the poetic of the poetic voice of Hamlet, because he sometimes expresses things that are just so beautiful about the human nature that sometimes we have to leave in a bit of that, even though it's not driving the action.
Yes. I mean, some of the beauty of that in action is in how he contemplates the two sides of, a particular action. Do I do this or do I do that? Right.
So, yeah. so okay. much of that.
Sure.
So yeah, that it kind of came out in the wash because we had quite a long process of since 2020 was right. the first Owning 100 workshop, and then 2021 we did another one, and then 2022 we worked for a short presentation at Maynardville, mm-hmm. still thinking we were going to Maynardville. Right. Then we worked for the National Arts Festival. So it wasn't done in lots of bits. And over that, but by 2022, by last year, we had a script that was pretty nailed down.
I see. And why didn't you go to Maynardville?
Well, the Baxter offered us to produce the production. So, you know, the insecurity of Maynardville. In fact, you know, we had been working for Maynardville for 4 years since 2018. And it had been in 2018, Brian, who was producing Maynardville, said they wanted to do Richard III mm-hmm. first. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, no, that's fine. I'm actually very busy this year. Let's postpone. We'll do it next year. And then there was COVID, and then there was, then there was no money. And then there was COVID, and then there was more COVID. And it was just, and also there was no money. So right. the whole thing had become so risky. It was like, to put Hamlet on at Maynardville, I had to take money out of my mortgage. Mm. You know,
sure.
and as a producer, that's sometimes the reality of what we have to do, right. but I don't really like to have to do that.
Absolutely.
And so when the Baxter yeah. came along and said, you know, we love what you're doing here. Would you like to come to us and we'll, you know, cover sure. the bottom line? Mm. I was just so happy. But also the Baxter is a beautiful space.
Mm-hmm.
Being in the theater mm. is beautiful. And mm. the concentration and focus that's required for appreciating everything that Hamlet is.
Yes.
I think the theatre space itself is very well, you know, it's a very good space
yeah.
to engage with yeah. that element of the production.
Sure. Sure.
But it seems that, I mean, on the Maynardville front, it seems that with the new energy that's come into mm-hmm. the production of it, you know, with Midsummer Night's Dream, but there's a new production team as well, that mm. it seems that it's back up on its feet, which mm. I'm very pleased yeah. and happy to see happened.
Yes.
to have seen happened.
Yes.
I think you better correct me.
Have happened was trust your gut. So I also wanted to ask about, you touched on this a little bit in terms of I'm going to ask about language, right? And how do you then deal with having two performers who are kind of have different histories and approach this from different positionings, but they have to embody one character, right? And you spoke about this a little bit in the video that was shared on the Baxter's page on Facebook to say, you know, what are the tensions? Are these three bodies in, you know, collaboration with each other? Or are they pulling away from each other? Can you talk a little bit about that and, you know, just the legacies of language, particularly in South Africa, and, you know, how you then make decisions in that particular space?
So are you asking about the way that we're using the character and the voices of the character, or about the performers?
The performers, yes.
Okay, so the performers, like I was saying about Siyam Thanda, his ability to memorize the words is quite phenomenal. But the accented delivery is a thing that had to be managed with a lot of care because I love accents and I think accents are extremely rich and give a lot to our reading of each other and the space, and they're very much part of the production that we're in, but you have to be able to understand.
Right.
And if you have that accent yourself, it can make it easier. And if you don't have that accent yourself, it can make it a lot more difficult.
Right.
So we had to find a middle ground working with the way that we worked was really centered around the meaning and finding that, you know, making sure that every single person was 100% clear about every single sentence.
Yeah.
And not only that they understood the general meaning of it, but understood why each word is where it is and how those words build into the meaning.
Right.
And that was once again, a very collaborative process. And here I really want to acknowledge Roshina Ratnam, because as a assistant director, you know, co-creator on this piece, she brought so much care to, you know, absolutely not compromising with any of the more emerging performers, to listen for, if they were hearing their own meaning, if they were delivering the meaning, and then, you know, sitting with them again and again, sometimes over the same pieces of text several times. Just being sure to hear back, what is this meaning for you? Yes. What are you hearing this in? And then have you considered this element of what's being said? And just bringing it round and round and round until the meaning is what was coming out. Then we also worked with Leslie Manham, who's a wonderful voice coach. And, you know, that's also important for people who haven't been through tertiary performance training. There's a lot about supporting the breath, you know, when you get anxious in performance. If you don't have some kind of support in your breath, then the meaning also collapses because the breath isn't inside the sentence to hold the sentence. So she worked a lot with the cast to develop those capacities. You know, and yet, to be honest, there still are things that we're working on inside of that. And I'm not only talking about the more junior performers. I regularly send, you know, notes to Mongi about, you know, sentences where words are backwards or things are, you know, it is phenomenally difficult to actually get those words out in the right order. And of course, if you've, one of the problems with our process was that, you know, because I told you in 2021, the second thing after the first, like, Owning Hamlet, which was just fun workshop, developing, discovering what these puppets could do, starting to talk to the puppets, finding all these exciting ideas. It was just a mishmash of ideas. But then in the second workshop, we really drove to stage something in 10 days, which was impossibly short and a phenomenal thing to do. But one of the consequences was that people learned too fast. And when you've learned something inaccurately, to relearn it and get that word order right.
It's already inside of you, so.
And I mean, I understood that intellectually, but I never really understood it until this January when we went to Chicago. Mongi didn't get his visa. Tim had to replace Mongi. So Tim did Hamlet and Claudius. Can you actually picture it? He was on stage, then he would be leaving stage, coming back on immediately in the, because it's always Claudius, Hamlet, Claudius, Hamlet, all the way through, right? Because they're the antagonists and the protagonist. So they just always on one or other of them. And Tim, I mean, wow, that's all I can say, because he did it and he learned all. I mean, he had done some of Hamlet before 10 years ago, but he, in 3 days of rehearsal, he did it. And he was already replacing Andrew from the National Arts Festival. So he was into relearning Claudius and the puppetry. He'd only done this, you know, SketchUp workshop in 2021. So he was now having to learn the precision of the puppet deliveries and two roles. We had a week, but there were only 3 days where we really realized Mongi was not coming. And he had to learn. We did track B. And then, you know, Tim knew he had to. Anyway, this is a long story to tell you. This snippet was that because we were now a cast member short, I had to jump in. So throughout the production, I was in it mostly as an arm support, you know, second pair of hands and holding up somebody's arm, which, trust me, is hard work. I really felt it. But then there were some scenes where everyone's on, the graveyard and the fight scene at the end, where Hamlet and Claudius are both on at the same time. They have to go at it. So I had to deliver Claudius's lines and those. And I had that feeling, you know, where your birthday party's over and you think, oh, I'm so sad after my birthday party. I thought when I was finished performing in Chicago, I was going to feel so sad. Oh, I'm never going to be performing again. But I can tell you what, I felt like this. Thank God, I'm going to avoid using a swear word. Thank God that's over, you know, and I can go back to where I belong, which is, I felt blind. I was inside the show. I couldn't see my own show. And it was so frustrating to me because as a director, I like to be able to see. And I really couldn't see what we were all doing. Anyway, the long story was about the learning of the lines. And I really understood how hard it is when you just put one word out in the beginning of your learning process and how much it takes to correct that one word later. Because I had a couple of words like that. And it was hard work. I was like, I came with a new level of respect for my actors and for what they go through. Empathy
just bubbling
up. Oh, man. Yeah. It is theater CrossFit, this. Yeah. You've got weight in your arm. You've got these massive words. And you're delivering all these intentions in different directions. And, I mean, I was doing a fragment, right? I was doing two scenes and lots of bits in between. But, wow, I really understood the power, the physical demand, and the mental dexterity that it takes to be able to.
Can you talk about the choreography? Like, because there's a whole lot of, like, there's scenes where one person moves from one puppet to the other. And, you know, there's this work of taking out these puppets and bringing them back on. So it's like there's the story that we're watching with the puppets, but there's this whole world of like kind of spirits that are bringing them on, taking them off, supporting. So how do you work out that whole language?
You know, I love that you mentioned that. And one of my favorite comments about the show was somebody after seeing it in Chicago, who really, really enjoyed it, loved the whole show. But she said, but, you know, one of the things that I found the most moving was seeing you all working together.
Yeah.
And the support that you're giving each other and how you're up in each other's armpits.
Yes.
And yeah. I was in South Africa 15, 20 years ago, and it didn't feel imaginable for me to see a group of people being that close and that trusting with each other.
Mm.
And I think that how do we do the choreography? It comes from that closeness. So we start with working with feeling each other's energy, which sounds like something from the lentil belt, right?
Right.
No, but I'm not talking about
it. I'm
reading your aura.
Right.
It's
but
walking
it's,
around the room
yes.
with the person next to you.
Yeah.
And then without speaking, there's a movement to move backwards. And
right.
then without speaking, there's a movement. So
right.
you're actually energetically sensing where the other body is about to move, then
yes.
you can start to give little signals, little breaths.
The kind of aesthetic connection.
And, yes.
kind of thing.
And so we build that up.
Right.
I don't work on like, oh, now your character's going to walk to the left gesturing
uh-huh.
into, no,
uh-huh.
none of that. I don't need to do that with my performers.
Mm.
They come up with those moves.
Mm.
They figure it out themselves.
Mm.
And they don't even need to know intellectually, at this moment, I'm gesturing like that. Because they feel each other, because the training that I give them is being able to feel each other. And then they can feel where the movement is going. Right? They feel the energy of that. Obviously, if the puppet's going this way, their arm that's on the inside is going in. And then there also is just technically, there's
yeah.
a training in puppetry. Obviously, you've got to keep the puppet open to the audience. Then there are things about counterweight, the second hand doing the opposite from what the main hand is doing, which might be counterintuitive because you think, oh, you know, you've got to go in sync.
The same way, yes.
But actually, it's not really interesting to have a character doing
right.
this all the time. I realize this is a verbal thing and I'm gesturing
sure,
all over
sure.
the place.
Apple.
But the hands going in the same place is
right.
not as interesting as one hand going and the other hand
is thinking. It's holding the thought.
Yes,
right.
Exactly.
Right.
And then the head finishes the thought and
yes.
the hand keeps on holding it
yes.
over there.
Yes.
So the head moves on, but
right.
the hand holds that thought.
Right.
So there's a lot of training around that, around the holding of thoughts in the limbs.
Right.
And that's where that choreography comes from. Then there's some big moves, you know, the ghost
yes,
scenes.
Yes.
It's very tightly choreographed,
yeah,
you know.
Yeah.
Now we're going to spread.
Yeah.
Then we're going to all whisk around and slap
right.
the ground.
Right.
Then we're going to jump. Then
right.
it's going to be murder. Boom, boom, boom.
Right.
So, you know, all the scenes are tight, but some of them took more choreographic work in terms of the bigger movements.
Mm.
You know, the closet
mm.
scene,
mm.
Hamlet whisking around and,
mm.
and pushing Gertrude down.
Mm.
That's a thing that you have to have, you know, four performers all working together and two puppets. So it's a lot of bodies in space and you really need to take the time to
tighten things,
figure those kind of moves out
right.
carefully.
Right.
But the dialogue choreography is all... It is fixed because they've done it many times
mm-hmm,
now,
mm-hmm.
but it all evolved out of
an intuitive
process.
Right.
And then, I would also give time to the performers like Mongi and Scott, same time as it was called.
Yes, sure.
So Mongi and Scott would want to work together on their monologues and they would be doing that. And then we would be working with somebody else on something else. So then they would themselves, the lead puppeteer doesn't have control over that second hand.
Mm.
And it, although we're talking about all of this, like feeling, whatever,
yes.
you know, it can
yes.
be a little frustrating
right.
when you want your hands to go,
right.
and then only one of them does it. And one is like hanging out of there, holding a thought that you're not trying
no,
to have.
We're past that. Catch up.
So
sure.
it's a back and forth
uh-huh.
between the felt thing
yeah.
and then the
where
lead puppeteer
right.
defining what he wants his character to do or
mm.
she wants her character to do.
Mm.
Or a combination of a negotiated position about what the collective who are creating
like that
character feels
like
needs
that.
To happen.
Sure. I like the negotiated position part of it because it's like, as the audience, you are reading that space of tension between these two bodies that clearly are of different kinds of backgrounds. And so I think with theatre, it has to be precise each day, right? We do say that you get to do it every day again, but you still have to deliver something that somebody can come back over and over and still, you know, have that same kind of experience. So to have seen how they managed to do the dance of three bodies. And I think it's, it then works out kind of as a serendipitous thing that you had to move into the space with puppets that you only had a limited amount of time to do, because it's almost like the, it's a fragment of the personality that gets completed by these two other bodies.
Yes.
That then make up this whole human being that we see in conflict with its many selves.
Yes.
So like that read so richly to me. And I'm curious about the division of the lines within one character.
Yes.
So then how do you decide what is Mongi, what is Scott or Siam Tan?
So you will have noticed that each of the characters who split or reveal, they're, it's quite different.
Yes.
You know, when you see Hamlet throws Gertrude aside,
yeah,
revealing the performer,
yes,
Rashina,
right,
it's very different from where Scott pulls out of Hamlet,
yes,
and starts to speak to him.
Right.
It's a very different energy.
Yes.
Communicates something entirely,
yes,
other.
Yes. I mean, there's also the moment with the ghost scene where one half of Hamlet is sucked into the ghost. That was, I was like, yes, because he's going somewhere else, right? But he's still here engaging with this thing. That was like...
So yeah, happy, sorry, you,
yeah,
saw that.
Yeah, yeah,
that,
yeah.
That, and that came from them. You know,
that was
absolutely interesting. You know,
beautiful.
Okay, so what I worked on with the performers is, who are these two aspects of Hamlet?
Uh-huh.
Who is Mongi? Mongi, uh-huh, is the, he's the part of Hamlet that is reflecting,
mm-hmm,
that is contemplative, that is pondering the nature of being. The part of Hamlet that really is not naturally somebody who would go and murder somebody else. And
the learned,
yes,
man who's come from,
yes,
this
and the education. And the one who loves thoughts.
Yeah.
The one who especially loves thoughts.
Right.
And then with Scott, we were working on the drive,
mm,
the longing, mm, to resolve,
mm,
the push,
mm,
to action,
mm,
and to,
mm,
revenge,
mm,
to righting this unbalanced situation that he finds himself,
right,
in. So that drive to action is embodied by Scott. And as we felt it, that drive to action is a little bit the darker side.
Sure.
It's,
I mean, it's almost carrying the justice, right?
Yes.
But it's also got this cruelty about it.
It's got a cruelty about,
right,
it. And it's got a self-judgment about,
right,
it.
Right.
So all the cutting stuff, the stuff that, you know, where Hamlet turns on himself or turns on Ophelia, a lot of that is driven by Scott's,
right,
part of the character.
Mm.
The division isn't completely,
mm,
clean cut. And what,
sure,
was interesting was I went through the script with those ideas in mind, going, this line for Scott, this line for Scott, this line. And then they, like, Mongi and Scott renegotiated, and there was a whole different... Some of them,
like,
were like,
we have to,
like,
do it, right?
Why is he saying that line?
Sure.
Why does... And then, you know, they had their reasons,
uh-huh,
and I would listen to them, and I would go, yeah, I get that.
Mm.
I get why that feels like your character,
right,
versus this guy. You know, and so it was a give and take, but the general principle of the thing was that there was this split between...
Mm.
The part that, you know, really doesn't want to commit revenge and,
sure,
wants to just be a person in the world.
Mm.
And this part that's driven towards action.
Mm.
And the frustration at the part that is driven towards action with the other part that's not taking the,
right,
action.
Right.
But then eventually the fact that the Mongi voice, which is clearly the dominant voice, is talked around or is actioned around by the fall of events, as well as by, you know, the feelings, the emotions. I would say it's more about the emotions and the way the events unfold that bring Hamlet, because he kills Polonius by,
yes,
mistake.
Yes.
And I think in the moment when he does that,
mm,
he finds himself the killer.
Right.
Without having made, he never actually made that choice.
Right.
He was thinking about it with,
right,
Claudius,
right,
and he doesn't do it.
Right.
And then,
when,
know,
he finally
and
does
he
take
does
action.
Take the action,
and
it's the wrong person. And I think he kind of, at that moment, he gives up on some element of himself, or,
mm,
he comes over to being a, you, because right after that, he also has Rosencrantz and Guildenstern
killed.
So there's,
like,
something,
wow,
very, he gets very cold and almost calculating,
right,
in his sort of attack. And the sense is there's no return.
Mm.
You know,
mm,
whereas before that, he's fighting to pull back.
Right.
Once that's out, he's just
gone.
He's on that train going,
yeah,
you know, to towards the inevitable, the thing that he's been pushed into by his fate, by,
sure,
his father,
sure,
by that voice in his head,
right,
whatever it is.
Right.
That, Yeah.
Sure.
So then we hear less and less from, because he doesn't need that, that other voice doesn't need to make himself heard because he's being
He's now heard. Acting. It's he's almost one voice.
He's in the dominant voice. Right. It's like when we have got, you know, I'm speaking to you right now, but if there's another part of me that doesn't agree, but if I'm all in agreement, then I don't feel that other part.
Yes.
But the dominant me is always the one that I experience in this moment. So we were sort of work down those lines, trying to tease it out.
Sure.
And then of course, Ophelia, for example, has got a very different manifestation of two voices.
Right.
Her two voices are about the fragmentation of the self. It's not about the argue. It's not about the conflict. It's about how she's drifting apart while trying to hold herself together. So the effort of the girls is always to try and come together, but they're being fragmented and pulled apart
and
by
the puppet also does it so in such a lovely way, because it there's parts where it just opens up and, you know, you can feel that trying to pull it back into, but it's almost like one voice cracking. Yeah. And becoming multiple voices, and you want to sing in harmony, but it's discordant, you know, and that was, and then there's the Claudius.
Yes. Claudius versus Claudius.
Oh, man. Can you talk a bit about that?
So of course that's like, he is looking at himself, but he isn't hearing two voices. His puppet, He's speaking and he's seeing into himself, but not with a different voice. Mm-hmm. It's just a different opinion about his voice. I don't know. I don't know if I'm expressing that clearly.
I hear you.
But
I'm hearing
that's why,
because he's post action. He's already acted on the intent, right? And so it's like the aftermath of that is now living with this thing. So I
he's
hear
commenting
you.
On his state of being, rather than in the thick of confronting his own
humanity.
His own questions about whether he should. I don't think Claudius really has questions about whether he should or shouldn't. We don't encounter whether he has them. Afterwards, he has a question about whether he should or have or shouldn't
have. Yeah.
But he's not currently asking himself what he should do. He doesn't ask himself whether he should or shouldn't poison Hamlet.
Right.
No, he's like,
this is it. Consequence.
So now I'm going, you know, so he just makes some commentary on himself. But I feel that every human being has those kind of, are we willing to hear them as an actual question, or an actual debate inside ourselves or not? And I feel like Claudius is not really willing. He doesn't really want to hear that inner voice. And that's why the puppet, you know, walks off and leaves Tim behind, holding this little, puppet of Hamlet. Yeah. And because I feel that even if we don't really see it in the text, there is a kind of regret that taking a human life is never, one is never left clean doing that.
Yes.
Even
if the guy if it's your brother, right.
Or your nephew.
Or your nephew,
is planning to kill Hamlet.
Yeah.
It's like, how can he do that?
Sure.
So, I think that's just, the ensouledness, which is written in, I felt like we had such a gift to be able to play with that, because the human being revealed from the puppet. And that's one of the things that I really enjoyed in this production, which has never been in anything else, is that when the puppet leaves the human being behind, how connected the human being feels. You know, even though you see them for such short amounts of time in the overall production, for me, they're the most powerful moments where you just see the actor and you're like, you know, Ophelia's puppet has been taken away from her and she's left reaching out, longing for that, for that body that is leaving her. And, so I just love those fragments of humanity that come through the actual human being.
Yes.
As much as I love what the puppet makes available in terms of our understanding of the character.
And then can you talk about, because I've often heard it said that there's a perspective that Shakespeare underwrites his women, right? And I heard this, I also encountered it in an interview with Helena Bonham Carter, and she was talking about the version of Shakespeare that I think Zaffarelli directed in 1991. And she was saying she was contemplative about playing the role because she felt like it was so underwritten, and she had problems with the questions of agency. And I'm curious about your perspectives around that. And then also yes. Gertrude as well, who I feel like there are moments where she's kind of just there in the space, you know, but she kind of fades away under this conflict between these other two bodies. So what do you think about?
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. Yeah. I think you're right. It was very much right from the beginning in our debating sessions about Gertrude and Ophelia and Shakespeare's women, you know, their tendency to sing, go mad and die without... But it kind of... It sort of is what it is, and what we tried to do was to look for how human we can make those people inside of what we have available to us.
Okay.
And this is primarily Hamlet's story.
Yeah.
I feel like in a parallel universe, I could have, you know, and I know people have done this before, Hamlet, or maybe Ophelia's story, maybe written Hamlet as a woman.
Right.
It is a story about being human and being in conflict, and Shakespeare did what he did at the time that he did it. I don't want to justify him.
Sure.
I don't think that I will be able to provide any interesting perspective on that. Sure. But it certainly is true that his women are underdeveloped as compared to the men.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's a sign of the time that he lived in. And it's a great pity because he's such an amazing writer. And, you know, it's our job to give them as much voice as they can have in today's world. Mm. And that includes some incredible interpretations which just regendify. And it's part of why, you know, we felt like we're talking about being human and human beings. So we're not going to be limited to men playing men's roles.
Right.
You know, just as in Shakespeare's day, we used to have men playing women. We're going to have women playing men because for us, the cast, the speaking parts, it's, you know, we're going to have all of that element of humanity represented and speaking.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we didn't turn Polonius into a woman.
Yes,
he's not a woman.
Course. He's still
but
Ophelia
he's voiced
Laertes
by Rashina as herself. She doesn't go and put on a man's voice,
yes,
you know.
Yes.
We did work with the distinction. We worked with distinction so that it wasn't the same voice as she was using for Gertrude.
Mm.
Or similarly with Tiamo doing, you know, Rosencrantz and Beverly doing Guildenstern. The other way around. You saw that moment,
okay,
I was like, okay. But they, you know,
but
we
they are kind
with,
of one.
Yeah, and the two of them became so united, partly because of the way that they were playing Ophelia and what we were looking for in Ophelia and how we wanted that sense of harmony, disharmony.
Mm.
Always working with the harmony and the disharmony within her.
Mm.
And so they became so harmonious as performers and so love and support each other. I mean, this is... For me, the extraordinary human thing about a team like this is you see these bonds happening between people as they're forced together by the circumstance of the creation.
Right.
That they find the human connection that just goes way beyond anything that, you know, is revealed on stage.
Right.
But I do feel that one does feel that connection on stage.
Yes.
That those two young women have just found this synchronicity.
Right. The energy's in sync, kind of. It's almost like, so there was a point that Cheryl Ann made to say, you know, the fabric that you used in terms of the puppets, the Hessian fabric, has its own kind of Victorian legacy. There's this article that you shared with me about the economy, cloth economies, right? And in the Victorian era, because people would have been, you know, clad in these velvety, you know, gowns and whatnot, it was an interesting comment for her to see the same characters, your Claudius, your Gertrude, your Hamlet, as in this Hessian fabric, which perhaps would have been ascribed to people in a lower class, right? And, you know, the comment that made in terms of, you know, but she would have asked that question in a more refined way. But, you know, just this connection rising up for me was, I just felt like I had to include that.
Mm. I think that wasn't a conscious part of the meaning creating, but what I love about sculpture, puppetry, working with objects is that the material carries its own meaning, brings its own sense of being in the world,
yeah.
as it were. Yes. Even though it's not being, yes. it's just yes. it's
yes.
a thing.
Yes.
But it has a quality to it. Yeah. It has a form. It has a way of moving, and yeah. that those things do feel mm-hmm. and capture something. Mm-hmm. And I think the reason that the Hessian stuck after that first workshop right. was because it was painting this picture of threads that connect us mm-hmm. As beings.
Yes.
I love the unifying quality of it, that it brings all these characters into one plane, but I also like its shredding. I love the fact right. that it's just,
right.
it's just
things
shredding
coming apart.
And falling apart.
And seeing the stories doing the same right. thing. The characters are doing the same thing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And at which point does it become the world? Because effectively, in between scenes, we're seeing, is it the same fabric?
Hessian, yes.
Yeah, on the wings and the legs,
and
yeah, right.
And, yes,
right.
Yes,
is it from that workshop that then becomes kind of the scenic landscape for the
that
production?
That was actually part of the very first concept. I wanted the whole, because in the very beginning I was thinking about Hamlet, they're all one characters inside of one mind. And then I was thinking to myself, wow, how are we going to create a space of a mind? It has to be something that's like, feels like we're inside of something.
Right.
And, you know, so that was sort of where this idea about this cloth hanging around came from.
Mm.
And it might even have been where the Hessian came from. And now that I'm thinking back, I think that might have been the first thoughts of the Hessian and how it drifted onto the puppet characters.
Sure.
So, yeah, so that
that's
was right in the beginning, like this something that
yes.
is textured,
yes.
that is connected, mm. but is... Oh, and in the beginning, I had this idea that all of these sort of stringy sort of things connected to the backdrop would be connected to the ghost.
Aha.
And that the ghost would be like underlying this whole world and this whole mind
yeah.
space that
yeah.
everything was taking place in.
Yeah.
And then that didn't materialize, okay. but it felt like it wasn't really needed. But I think that the stringing and those big ropes and so on hanging out of us.
I think in a way then it's almost like we're inside of, like you say, a mind, and these characters, because they are of the same material as, you know, the curtains inside the mind, it's almost it's like that aspect for us as the audience kind of reads to say they are kind of, if it's the inside of my brain, right, you know, these masks are coming in, like something is kind of poking into it and creating the bodies that stretch in and kind of stretch out and go back into the wall. So like,
oh, that's so great that you saw all
of
that.
I loved it. I really
and,
love that.
Yes, exactly. That you know, I don't think many people would have got what you got if
sure.
you felt that thing
sure.
of them reaching in and out of the mind
right.
because it wasn't articulated enough in the whole production concept.
Uh-huh.
But I feel like what people can get is that they kind of fibrously belong to one space, and the space that they belong to is not a historical Denmark. This who they are and what they represent is they're like the fabric of us, rather than that they are the king and the queen
right.
and the da 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 da.
Right.
But they are these figurations
mm.
of us.
Mm-hmm.
That was, and I mm. feel like people might get that.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Did you use any Carl Jung in your preparation? I don't know if you.
I mean, just in the sense that I'm interested in psychology and
right.
Jung, and
right.
yes, exactly, the unconscious.
Because that was my first thing. It was like, I'm looking at the split between the persona and the shadow. I'm looking at the collective unconscious that, and now as you're speaking about this, the levels of collaboration in like holding up a puppet, but also in developing the language of the production, in finding the spoken language in, you know, so how all of these multiple threads keep converging, coming together to create, you know, this body that keeps rising up. It kept making me think about, you know, Jung's idea of, you know, how we're split between the mask that we give to the world and then
yes.
our shadow self
yes.
that is connected to this collective unconscious.
Yes.
So
which
curious.
We're not always aware of how
right.
it's connected, right?
Right.
But as a team, we did work very consciously and spoke on a number of occasions about the fact that we are connected and we're connecting into something that comes from long ago and elsewhere
mm.
into here and now
mm.
and how those threads of connection are actually weaving us all with our audience yes. into a space. So right. yeah, we talked about those sure. Elements. Sure. Definitely.
Sure. Last two points I'd love for you to think through. The global legacy of Hamlet, right? Because a lot of people often say it's the greatest play ever written by the greatest playwright who ever wrote any plays, right?
So no now, pressure, right? Yeah, I don't know if I can deal with this.
So I'm curious now about like, the way you're thinking around, and I mean, you've touched on it with like the imposter syndrome, but this play has its own legacy, its own stories, its own kind of, you know, following. Did that factor into any decisions that you made in terms of staging the production?
I really tried to put the historical weight of the production aside.
Okay.
Because it's so flippant and intimidating to yes. start thinking about everything that has gone before right. this production.
Right.
And I really focused into what we have to bring, how we connect with the material, how we connect with the character.
Yes.
And I think it encouraged the cast to go in that direction.
Right.
And then I was surprised and delighted by, because for me it was the only option to be able to survive the experience of all that weight and that pressure. I couldn't get into like, what has everybody done with Hamlet? Yeah. How did everybody interpret Hamlet? No, that's right. going to just drive me mad sure. in the creative process. So just, you know, bringing the focus into the room, bringing the energy into the room, bringing all of our contributions together into this one melting space yeah. of discovery and creation.
Yeah.
Was exciting, and it became so riveting that actually we've quite quickly forgot that we were afraid of doing it, you know. Beautiful. It just became like that.
Yes, this is
and
ours.
Then, you know, when yeah. we would get comments like coming out at the National Arts Festival, this one woman said, oh, she has got season tickets to the Globe Theatre. I thought, oh my God. And then she said, yes, and this is the best piece of Shakespeare she's ever seen. I was like, oh, okay, all right then, okay, now I'm going home with my naughty badge or whatever. Sure. So, you know, people are really responding to it as something that speaks to that tradition yes. in whatever way it does.
Yeah.
I'm sure there are people, you know, who feel that way. There are other people maybe who don't, right. but at least if it even touches a few people as something of a perspective. I mean, I don't even really care about it being a very unique Hamlet.
Mm-hmm.
All I think about is if people are like getting, even one moment of a unique window on what it means to be human. That's for me all that really matters.
That's beautiful. I might edit this so that is the last thing that you say, because that's just like a beautiful ending. But so you're a theater maker in South Africa, and that comes with the challenges of time, resources, funding, all of this different stuff, right? But there's also, or well, I feel, a kind of a responsibility that we have with the work that we do, to speak back to the society that we currently live in. So I'm curious about your thoughts around how Hamlet kind of does that. Does it do that for you in any way? Does it speak back to our current situation in South Africa? If so, how? And then maybe your reflections on being a theatre maker and finding more life for this production, like where to from here?
Sure. So for me, making theatre, the most beautiful thing about making theatre is that connection in the space with the cast, and the fact that we as theatre makers have the privilege of creating a profoundly mixed room where we can meet each other on a level that you just can't in passing. I think few people
yes.
outside of the theatre have yes. the opportunity to meet on the level that we have.
Right.
It's really such a privilege, and it can't be wasted. We need to use every moment of that, not for some kind of personal catharsis, mm. but to bring to each other that, you know, we can find each other humanly, and we need to find each other humanly. This is the big critical challenge that we have to engage in. I think so.
Yeah, sure.
I feel like we really need to
yeah.
push beyond what's comfortable in yeah. doing that.
Mm.
So for me, the quality of energy between people in the rehearsal room is the first point of engaging with the localization, if you would,
yes.
of Hamlet.
Yeah.
The play itself for me is, I think, profoundly, can be related profoundly to our own historical context mm-hmm. in the sense that there's so much wrongdoing in our immediate past. Mm. what is the course of action that's going to set things right? Mm. And it's a big question, you know, cursed spite that ever I was born to set this right.
Yes.
What does it mean to set things right? Does it mean to take revenge?
Sure.
And if you're driven by revenge, where will that land?
Right.
And how can we be inside of this space of ours in a way that can take us somewhere poetic in our souls in relation to all the pain that we've faced, all the pain that we are facing, everything that is currently, you know, in the course of the rehearsal process, we had one of our cast members' brother was shot. We had, people were held up at gunpoint, and people other than, you know, I was hijacked at gunpoint during the course of the rehearsal process. So, you know, we live with a level of vulnerability and a level of pain. And scale of emotion. We live with a scale of emotion and being in this country that I think is very high. I think we live on quite a high vibration of being.
Yes.
Not in the necessarily.
That's why we joke.
Way.
That's why we joke whenever there's something.
Shit. I mean, it's a lot.
Yeah, it is. So you must laugh or you'll die.
You must laugh.
Yes.
And then you must bring it into the rehearsal space, right? And one of the things that I love about Shakespeare is not afraid of big stuff.
Mm.
And one of the things that I really loved, which we discovered, was that as we were doing it with puppets, we could get away with bigger things.
Mm.
You know, when an actor stands on stage, he can't necessarily throw his arms wide and say,
right.
Oh, this too, so, you know, so but fast, a puppet can do it.
Yes.
A puppet can get away with it, you know?
Yeah.
So we were able to just bring that bigness into the being, yes.
Sure.
Which I think is, it's good for us. We need to feel the feelings. We need to be in the fury also, you know, not necessarily for any kind of intellectual process or realization. It could be,
mm-hmm.
but it's not necessary for that. It's just being able to feel, oh, it's hard to be human,
yes.
You know?
Yeah.
Is it better to face those slings and arrows or to not? But when you are able to feel the feelings of being human, then it feels like, all right,
yeah.
I can get on with another day of challenges,
sure.
Whatever they may be.
Sure, yeah. Sure. And I mean, that touches South Africa, the continent, and the globe.
Right.
So where to from here?
Well, today I'm busy purchasing flights for our trip to Budapest.
That's awesome.
We're going to Budapest in May.
Okay.
I'm busy talking to a producer in London who's really wanting to bring it there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, you know, details about when all of that's going to happen.
Sure.
But yeah, I would love to see Hamlet go places.
Mm.
It's always just a division of, I think it's like a division of myself.
Yes.
Because there's a whole bunch of productions and each one of them has a huge amount of love, passion, and a huge amount of my heart inside of them. And then there's all the admin, which doesn't have so much of my love, passion, and heart inside of it. But without which, nothing goes anywhere.
Yeah.
So I have to distribute the amount of me that's available to do the less lovely stuff, which is, you know, the management of everything.
Yeah.
Between all of these productions that I really care about.
Sure.
But Hamlet is close to my heart, I've got to tell you. And I think that means it will go somewhere.
I see. So for the young and emergent theatre maker, how do you manage that? This is the final question. How do you manage that division of self across the passions and the dreaded, right? That stuff that brings your soul to light and that stuff that kind of sucks your soul.
Yeah, I try and remember the feeling that I had when I was producing the Out the Box Festival. There was a puppetry festival here in Cape Town, which I ran for about 7 or 8 years.
Mm.
And eventually what I got to was, because when I was running the festival, I obviously couldn't make work necessarily at the same level. I was making work. I was continuing to make work and run a festival.
Right.
And produce and raise funds for it and, you know, and eventually what I could see was that the festival was like a mega creation. It was something that made all these human connections possible that I wasn't in control of.
Mm-hmm.
Like I wasn't in control of the room as I am with the rehearsal room.
Right.
But in a way, on some level, that was quite delightful to see all these things happening, these explosions of creativity. And so the reward from that work comes from the feedback of seeing it existing. And in a way, each creation, each production is like a little microcosm of that.
Yes.
It's like when you see the performance on stage, the emotional payback is so big that it actually drives you through the next moment of, and when I, you know, when I see what it's doing for my performers to have this, you know, professional trajectory in front of them, you know, it just feels so motivating to carry on closing those gaps and booking the flights and making sure people turn up for their visa appointments and, you know, all of those things that one has to do to, because I mean, I don't personally, I love drawing up budgets. I think budgets are really fun because it's nice actually to figure out how to move them. The problem comes in when you have some money and you don't have enough money and you have to start cutting here and cutting there and then going, well, what if we do this? And what if I take myself out of all the lines altogether? Can we still make this happen? And then there's something quite satisfying about that. You know, when you think it's an impossibly small amount of money and then it happens anyway. And when people come to the party and then when there's suddenly more money than you expected there was going to be. Which also,
that's
which
a different kind of challenge.
Yeah. So it does happen. Yeah. I think when suddenly there's an amount of energy, because I think money is just a reflection of a kind of energy. And some people have very good energy for finding the money in advance of the product happening. But some people like me somehow need to sort of
make the work,
force themselves along until there's something there. And then people feel it and they put the energy into it. So it's you know, it's exchange. It, the feedback is immediate when the results are on the floor.
Yeah. Thank you so much for this. This has been incredibly delightful for me in my role as a teacher, because I know it's going to be amazing for the students to listen to this, but also as a theater maker, because you're bringing back something inside of myself that I also have kind of a tentative relationship with. At times I'm closer to this passion and fire, and at times I'm a little bit further away. But like you say, there are those encounters and experiences that give you so much that it carries you forward until the next time you're able to do the thing that you love. So this has been one of those moments that I'm going to carry in my body, and I'm going to transfer to my students tomorrow and just keep on spreading this energy. So I'm really incredibly grateful for your time, and thank you. This
has been awesome. Well, thank you, Katleho. I mean, I think that it's such a privilege to actually get to reflect with somebody who has seen and understands. And that's what I really experience in you, that you've seen, and I don't just mean physically, you know, but you've really experienced the work. You've seen it on every level, and that you've also got the experience of this world behind you, this creative world, this world of language, this world that you're coming from, the artistic relationship with the material that you're interacting with. It's a real privilege to talk to you. Thank you for spending the time asking me questions.
I mean, keep making shows and I'm going to keep showing up.
Okay.
Cool. Thanks, Jen. Hey. Awesome.
We how just long is have that? To be each other's mutual fan clubs.
Yes, definitely.
This has been so delightful for me. I'm really
glad. I'm really glad.
I'm like, oh, what an absolute joy.